This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, welcome to Life Matters. Thanks for joining me. I'm Kate Evans, sitting in just this week for Richard Adie. Today, alternative education and families after separation. But we begin with an international story. Some of the first results are coming in from a massive exercise in social engineering that's been underway in Britain. And it seems the main purpose of the Sure Start program, an improvement in the lives of the most disadvantaged children and their families, is not happening. Not only that, but these families, typically jobless teenage single parents, are being adversely affected by Sure Start. Professor Edward Melwish is the Executive Director of the National Evaluation of Sure Start, based at Birkbeck University in London. He's currently in Australia. Professor Melwish, welcome to Life Matters.
Welcome. Thanks very much.
We've looked at Sure Start a few times on Life Matters, so I wanted to check some details with you. It's essentially an early intervention program for children in areas designated as socially deprived. The way it was conceived, these local areas would then get inundated with supports for education, health and parenting, and it would be universal. Everybody in those areas would be offered the same help. Is that a fair description?
More or less, except that because the programs were offered almost complete local control, the actual pattern of services delivered across the country varied enormously from program to program.
Was that an important part of the conception of it, that there'd be that local autonomy?
It was felt at the outset that community control was critical to the success of the program. It had some positive benefits and it had some downsides as well.
Well, overall, it does sound like a very positive program.
Yes.
So in what way, though, is that program working against the interests of the most needy families? What are the problems that you've identified?
Well, the first thing is that because of the huge local autonomy that there was in the program, there was immense diversity in the programs. And it would be unrealistic to expect all of these immensely diverse programs to work equally well. And we found that that was so, that there was great variability. Some programs working pretty well, some doing not very so good, and some doing pretty badly. And also it needs to be borne in mind that previous to 1999, there was nothing of this kind in Britain. And they were trying to set up a system of services from scratch, effectively. And, of course, there's a great learning process to be undergone. This is a learning process which needs to take place in government, but also in terms of the staff involved, in terms of getting a adequate trained workforce who are used to delivering these services. Because, as I say, before 1999, there was none of it.
So these services are being accessed, clearly, yes, by some people who really need it.
Yes.
But what are you finding about the most disadvantaged group in the UK?
Right. What we did is we, in the early stages of the program, we compared families and children in Sure Start areas with similar areas which weren't receiving Sure Start yet, but within the future. And what we found is the majority of the families were benefiting from being in the Sure Start program. But there were some families, which, as you say, could be regarded as the most disadvantaged, a teen, mums, workless households, lone parents and so on, where they weren't doing so well and seemed to have some possibly negative effects upon them. Now, this is probably because in the non-Sure Start areas, they're effectively working on the old system of service provision, where those services which are available were highly targeted on the most severely disadvantaged. Now, the ethos of Sure Start programs was, if you lived in a deprived area, everybody got the service. So, and also, staff in this new service were very keen to get the participation rates up as high as possible. So they got lots of people involved as quickly as they could. And what tended to happen there, I think, is that maybe they lost sight of the ball, as it were, with regard to the most disadvantaged, who may have been rather marginalised a little bit, possibly.
Well, that's where it's hard to imagine how they then actually were worse off.
Well, if you think about the comparison areas where they were the only people receiving services, then it becomes clearer to understand why that might happen.
So comparatively worse
off. That's right.
Tell me then about what's been working the best, because there are some things where there have been improvements in all sorts of things. About parenting in particular is a real focus of Sure Start,
right,
isn't it?
Now, in many ways, Sure Start's been a great success story, because in the early stages of the program, there were definite mistakes made and people have been learning from those mistakes. And one of the great successes is the way the government's been listening to the evidence and changing the program to take account of that evidence. And Sure Start programs now are becoming what we call children's centres, where they would be a more closely defined set of services provision and also closer guidelines about how those services should be delivered, which should probably get over a lot of the problems which happened early on. But what works best is this. Those programs which have a very clear integration of health services into the program tend to work better. And this is because health services hold the birth records for all families. So they immediately know when a new baby's born.
And does that mean they can then follow up with the family?
And they can get, they contact the family immediately. The health visitors and midwives are on board. If the health visitors and midwives, in the course of their ordinary daily routine visits, find that there's a family which has a specific need, they can signpost that family towards a service that they know exists in the Sure Start program. And so that family gets picked up by the relevant services. However, where you don't get close integration of the health services, then the program is often spending a lot of time just finding out who are the appropriate families to deal with in that area. And that takes a lot of time and resources, and they get to the families later. And often, and it's generally the case that the earlier you deal with a problem, the easier it is to deal with it.
So what does that mean then for the challenges to the group we were talking about, the most disadvantaged families? Is it a case of it being a waiting game?
To some extent it's a waiting game. First of all, there's this. If you look at almost every intervention program that's been done around the world, it's the families who are disadvantaged but not the most disadvantaged who tend to come on board sooner. The most disadvantaged tend to be a little bit more suspicious of services. But when they see their neighbours benefiting, and after a year or so, then they say, oh, maybe this isn't so bad, such a bad idea after all, and they come on board.
So how else do you deal with that suspicion? Because I imagine it's about state intervention, feeling that they're under surveillance, in the way that the poor in society tend to be.
Well, you've got to build up trust with parents. This is absolutely critical for these sorts of services to work well. And this is where you'll need parental involvement in the services. Another factor we found was influential in those programs which are most successful is that they had systems in place to ensure the empowerment of both the parents and the staff in the program, so that if the parents were reporting something wasn't working for them, or the staff reported something wasn't working, things would be put right quite quickly.
But on the other hand, that empowerment by both the parents and the local staff sounds like that's about local autonomy. But
that's
you
right.
Found that local autonomy isn't always a signpost to
local
success.
Local autonomy is important, and local ownership is important. But people need guidance about what works. One of the problems with the early stages of the program was there was a very high level of local autonomy, but without the requisite expertise being present locally. Whereas now we're building up that expertise locally, we're giving firmer guidelines to them about what works, we're showing them what works and what doesn't work, we're allowing them to choose from a menu of services where all the items on that menu work, and they can choose which items suit their local area.
On Life Matters this morning on ABC Radio National, I'm Kate Evans, and with me is Professor Edward Melwisch, who is the Executive Director of the National Evaluation of Sure Start. And we're talking about this social policy initiative in the UK, which is Sure Start. You also talked about the variability in Sure Start in different
yes.
areas. Does that mean there's a move for a more consistent national approach?
Yes, that's right. The programs are becoming children's centres, and one of the things that's happening with children's centres is that a clearer set of guidelines is being issued. And those set of guidelines are being constructed on the basis of what worked in the best programs early on, and also from other evidence that's available. We found, for example, in one of my other projects, which is called the EPI Project, which is a parallel project to the evaluation of Sure Start, we found that what we call integrated centres, which were the forerunners of children's centres.
Sorry, can you tell me more about the children's centres? How do they work?
Well, children's centres integrate health services education services, social services, voluntary services, all within one centre. So whatever kind of family or child service you need, you can get it from the one location. And because the staff are co-located with each other, when a staff in one profession, like a health visitor, sees a problem that can be dealt with by another professional, like, say, a speech therapist, they can direct the family in the appropriate way.
And you've seen the effects of that, haven't you? Particularly in the sort of, not to sound too hierarchical, but in the next rung up the ladder. Not the most disadvantaged, but the people who then, I guess, have more cultural capital and able to access things. So what are the positive impacts you're seeing there? Is it about parenting? Is it about family structures? Where are you seeing it?
Well, in the very early stages, we're seeing the effects on parenting, where the families seem to show more acceptance of their child's behaviour, less physical punishment in their parenting. We see less chaos in the households, where the household seems to be more carefully structured for bringing up children. And so it's aspects of parenting which are happening initially. But these are aspects of parenting which we know from other studies are likely to lead to improvements in child behaviour. And we saw in some of our families improvements in children's social development as a consequence of these changes in parenting behaviour.
And in fact, you're a specialist in children's social development, aren't
you? That's right.
That's your academic specialisation.
That's right.
So do you see the negatives then as a major setback, or are you feeling quite positive about where Sure Start can lead? And I guess I'm asking that because I'm wondering what we in Australia can learn from that experience.
I think with the moves towards children's centres, I feel positive, because the government has taken on board the messages of the research and realised that in the early stages there were good things and there were bad things. They've started to pick out the good things, and they're going with those, and they're starting to eliminate the bad things.
Well, of course, we'll keep a close eye on that as well. So, Professor Melwisch, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Life Matters.
Thanks.
Professor Edward Melwisch is the Executive Director of the National Evaluation of Sure Start, based at Birkbeck University in London. He addressed a seminar last Friday at the Centre for Community Child Health in Melbourne, and will do the same in Sydney today at the Social Policy Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. I'm Kate Evans, this is Life Matters, and we're turning to education in just a moment.
Well, our good times are all gone, and I'm bound for moving on. I'll look for you if I'm ever back this way.
Yes, it's Johnny Cash with one last album, American 5, 100 Highways, is our feature CD today on the Daily Planet, which is on at 20 past 2 this afternoon, or 20 past 11 tonight. It's also the feature CD on Radio National Breakfast all this week, so you can hear lots of how this man of much experience and wisdom triumphs in his telling of tales through songs, despite his sometimes ravaged voice.
Now on Life Matters, we turn to education. Could you imagine your child chairing primary school staff meetings? Do you think that your child should have a say in what they learn and how they learn it? Speakers at the 12th International Democratic Education Conference, which is happening in Sydney this week, certainly do think that. In a moment, we'll find out just what is meant by the term democratic education by speaking to one of its key proponents from the US, as well as meeting a former student of a local democratic school, Currumbina in Sydney. But first, we take a look at this form of education in action. Radio National's Tom Morton took a trip to Currumbina to find out how it all works.
People just put up their hand in school meeting, and school meeting's when the whole school gets together and we talk about issues about the school, like if something bad's happened, we'll talk about that, and if we want to make something happen, we'll talk about that, and if we're going on an excursion with the school, we'll talk about that. And we have two chair people at the front. Everyone gets a chance to chair except for preschool.
And who are the chair people? Are they the kids or teachers?
They're kids. Chair people are always kids.
So my impression is the kids are quite involved in the way the school runs and the way the school works.
Yeah, the kids are most of it, and we all count as equals. The teachers don't count as anymore, but they count as equals as well.
Oh, yeah! Introduce Tom Monton by Chris.
Introduce Tom Monton by Chris.
Oh, okay. I want to introduce Tom Monton, which is this man here that's got the headphones on and the microphone. He's from ABC Radio and he has come...
So, tell me a bit about the meetings, how they work.
Well, first they go around to different classes and get the subjects that they have from their class, because each class has probably written their subjects on their whiteboard or something. And so then we all go into the meeting and the people that are chairing pick hands. They say the subjects and then people put up their hands for things to say.
Next subject.
Cubby by Alex.
Cubby by Alex.
Well, we've done a tubby near that long tunnel. And I want to know, can I keep it?
Who doesn't want Alex to keep his cubby?
Whenever someone has an argument, they sort it out in a way where the teacher sits down and listens to both sides and you're allowed to speak and say your own point of view and say what you think should happen and a punishment if there's going to be one.
The punishments are given by the kids in school meeting or class meeting, or in a problem we suggest what they should think and the teachers sort of just reinforce it and say, right, yeah, you've done something wrong and you need to make amends for it.
And you can hear more of Tom's program about the history of democratic education, or progressive education as it's also called, on Hindsight this Thursday at 1 p.m. here on ABC Radio National. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a conference on right now examining this form of education. And with me is Gerry Mintz, founder of the Alternative Education Resource Organisation, who's one of the conference speakers. Hi, Gerry.
Hi, nice to be here, Kate.
Tell me, was that a fair representation of the form of schooling you support, that piece that we just heard?
I think so. Of course, every school is different. They're all unique. There are, several hundred democratic schools around the world. In fact, we have them. People can find them on our website, which is educationrevolution.org, and they can go to a table of these schools and see them and see their websites and so on. But I think that's fair. I think the kids really feel empowered. They feel like they have some say about how the school works and they have some freedom educationally.
Well, tell me more then about exactly what you mean by democratic education. You mentioned empowerment of students, but how do you define this form of education?
Again, it varies from school to school, but the basic concept is that the kids actually have a literal vote as to how their school works. And this, if you think about it, you know, shouldn't democratic countries be having their kids grow up in a democratic learning situation? Why are they growing up in an authoritarian one? What is that training them for?
What does this work for all students, though? I'm wondering if I imagine there are kids who are going to absolutely thrive being asked to make these decisions, and other children for whom it might be intimidating or might make them anxious. I mean, who doesn't it work for?
Kids are natural learners. This has been borne out by brain research. So the younger you start, the better it is. And I think that the concept that the traditional schools, the regular public and even private schools operate on, is that kids are naturally lazy and need to be forced to learn. Well, that becomes self-fulfilling after a while when you extinguish this natural ability to learn, you see.
I'm just wondering, though, if natural learners and being a natural leader are the same thing, because making the decision about your curriculum or having the opportunity to learn as much as possible, they aren't necessarily the same thing.
You'd be amazed. Very young kids are able to take on tremendous responsibility, have tremendous insights into things and so on. And I think that people don't realize this because they're put into a system that tends to take that away from them.
And Gerry, how did you come to this philosophy of education? It was a very personal experience, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it goes way back. I mean, in my life, you can go back to when I was 15 years old and I was dissatisfied with my school and organized my friends into a little club and we could discuss anything we wanted. We had our own guest speakers and so on. Then when I was in my 20s, I started a couple of schools, and I ran one for 17 years. And then I started the organization that I run now, which is called AERO, Alternative Education Resource Organization. And we network these alternatives all over the world.
Well, let's turn then to how it works all over the world. I'd like to welcome now a former student of one of Sydney's alternative primary schools, Currumbina, which we also heard about a little earlier. Amy Mortimer has also been inspired to continue work in this area, doing postgrad research into alternative education. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
You say that your time at Currumbina was the highlight of your schooling years. Now, why is that?
I felt that at Currumbina we were made to feel that everybody was equal and we were treated and valued as individuals. And we learnt as much academically as we did socially and emotionally. And we really sort of were we were encouraged to be decision makers and thinkers and doers. And we really valued. And one of the reasons I'm now a primary school teacher and one of the reasons I went into teaching was because I wanted to give back to my class of kids what I got out of education.
And we heard in that little clip students chairing their own meetings. That's that something that you remember doing? What did that feel
definitely.
Like?
Yeah, I remember being on the chair and being very nervous, but also very supported by the other teachers and the other students there. You were never set up for failure or you were never made to feel intimidated. So if you didn't want to speak or you sort of clammed up, it was okay. There were other kids who would help you out.
Well, how did that compare, though, with your other school experiences? Because I believe you went to the UK were in a very different type of school.
That's right. When I was eight, my family moved back to the UK and I went straight into a mainstream school there. And it was a completely different world, and we line up girl, boy, girl, boy. And we just did as the teacher was told. But, I mean, children adapt very quickly, and we did. We adopted the North London accent. But I never lost that feeling of I have individual rights and I have a voice, and what I say will be listened, not in an arrogant way, will be listened to, but I shouldn't feel shy. And I remember one teacher holding us all back in break because one of the boys was naughty, so we all had to sort of pay for that. And I remember putting my hand up saying, you know, actually, I think that's a little unfair. Da, 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 da. And so I just thought, yeah, I'm still going to stand up for what I believe in. Not in a pushy way, but just because that's what I felt. And I think that's what Currumbina really taught us to do.
Gerry Mintz, I'd like to come back to you. Tell me about the curriculum. How structured is it and how does it relate to the mainstream school curriculum if we take, say, the US for example?
Well, basically, the approaches for most of these schools are learner-centered as opposed to curriculum-driven. There's curriculum involved. It's covered maybe in a different way, but it's based on the interest of the student. And again, this varies from school to school and according to what the state and country laws are in each place. But it's a curriculum that is connects much more to the interest of the student.
And what does this what does this mean for things like university access and so on? How do you measure the outcomes then if the kids want to go on to another type of education?
Well, I can't speak for here, but in the United States, the success of kids in this kind of approach is so stunning that the colleges want them, and we're including home education as part of this too, but they are very happy to get kids who come from democratic schools, alternative schools, and even homeschool situations.
But how do your educational aims fit in then with government policies like the No Child Left Behind legislation?
Well, of course, again, that varies. But for private schools, they're not so beholden to that approach. We think that it's a disaster, the No Child Left Behind approach, because I think it's the death throes of an old system. People who can't figure out that the times have changed, that we're in an information society now, and we need lifelong learners. And to cram information down kids' throats, is only going to turn them against learning.
And I believe that there's also some similar conflicts as to what happens in Australia, which is it's also a conflict between a federal and a state-based system.
We know of schools in Australia that have gotten into trouble because of this conflict. And I think it's actually a very serious problem. The interesting thing is in Australia, from what I understand, it's all or nothing. If you're a private school that's sort of accepted, you'll get some funds. And if you're not, you can't even be a school. And I think there's something wrong with that.
And we probably can't get into what the definitions of community schools and how that funding system works at the moment. But, Amy, I'd like to get back to you. Given that you went from your own school experience to analysing education systems in your postgraduate work, looking at it in that analytic way, how would you assess your educational experience at Currumbina? Was it entirely positive? Were there things that could have been done better?
Well, for me, Currumbina is an Aboriginal word that means happy place, and for me it was very much a happy place, and I didn't have any negative experiences there whatsoever. In fact, when I went back to the UK, I was ahead academically in terms of times tables and languages and all sorts of things. And then when but not everybody experienced that, and my study showed that, you know, some people, it's not for everybody. And some people were critical of it, and other people, they thrived on it. So it was a real mix, and I think it really depends on the child and what you and the parent and how it can benefit each individual.
And there was also a division within the community of the school that you found as well. Can you tell me briefly what was at the heart of that split?
Maybe
you can be closer to the microphone.
Yeah, there was an original split in the early days of Currumbina. I think that there's always that thing between the social and learning and the academic learning. But they follow the national curriculum, follow the Board of Studies there, so they do the New South Wales curriculum.
Tell me how that works then. If you've got a national curriculum, what can the students then do themselves to intervene in? Is it about how they'd like the curriculum taught, the order that it's done? Tell me more about how that works in a classroom.
Well, I don't know I can't remember how it worked when I was a student there. I know that we covered everything. I think you just have a little bit more of a say of how we're going to do it. And it's not sort of sit down, like we're doing HSIE now, or we're going to do maths now. You might do maths through building a cubby house. Or when I was a child there, we actually wrote a book. And so we had lots of literacy there, and we it was involved in life skills as well. So, yes, you employ those outcomes-based curriculum within life skills and more of an interesting child-centred way.
And are you able to take any of those principles and apply them yourself as a teacher?
Yeah, absolutely. I try and do that in my classroom. I'm a little more restricted because I have to follow the curriculum more closely, I guess, but I try and employ a lot of progressive ideologies in terms of having little class meetings and things like that.
Well, Jerry Mintz, let's talk more about that. Are any of the ideas of alternative education, do you think, being adopted in mainstream schools in the US? Is there a sense in which the different principles of education can come together?
There's no doubt that there are sort of two revolutions going on opposite each other at the same time. You've got, as you mentioned, this No Child Left Behind. On the other hand, you've got home education and democratic education and alternative schools just exploding in growth, and it's happening all over. And this is the first time that this particular conference has been in Australia. Might not be back here for a long time. So I think we should let people know that they can get involved with it. They can come up to this conference.
And we'll put all of the details on our Life Matters website,
We've had it in Israel, Australia, Ukraine, India, Japan, New Zealand, and so on. And we hosted it ourselves in 2003. But it is catching on all over the world, is what I'm saying.
So catching on rather than being completely divergent.
That's right.
Thank you very much, both of you, for speaking to me. And Jerry Mintz and Amy Mortimer. Amy Mortimer is a former student at Currumbina School, and Jerry Mintz is an alternative education advocate. And all the details of the website of the conference for those people who are in Sydney will be on the ABC website at abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. And coming up here on Life Matters, more children's voices, what 14-year-old Jessica thinks about life after her parents' separation.
Hello, I'm Emma Griffiths in the medieval city of Tallinn, the capital of Estonia, fast becoming a favourite haunt for bad boy Brits.
Spending our money over here, the economy needs it.
Hello, I'm Eric Campbell. I'll be reporting on the push to bring Sharia law to Indonesia. The pornography issue isn't just a source of power for the radical Islamists. There's strong evidence it's also a source of money.
That's Foreign Correspondent, 9:20 Tuesday, ABC TV.
Now on Life Matters, to the next in our series looking at the changes to parenting arrangements after separation. In this week's program on residence arrangements for children, we hear from Jessica, the eldest of four. After a period of conflict with her mother's new partner, she decided at the age of 14 to live permanently with her dad while her siblings remained with her mother and stepfather. A new four-year-old half-brother has also changed the family dynamics.
My name's Jessica and I'm 18. Well, there's eight of us, I think. There's Jack, who's our half-brother and he's four. There's the younger sister, Hannah, who's 14. Then Sarah, who's 15. Then Michael, who's 17. Then me, who's 18. Then my mum, then my dad and my stepdad, David. I was about seven when my parents started to break up. My dad left about four times and came back and left and came back because he was lonely, I think. But while they were together, it was just pretty crazy, a lot of fighting, was very comfortable. Yeah, that's all I really remember. when my parents split up, I don't remember how they decided. It just was more acceptable that the mum got the kids. But my mum did struggle a bit and Dad did offer to take us, but that never happened. When my parents broke up, it was not practical for my dad to have us. He was in and out of, you know, boarding with people. Yeah, it was really impractical at the time. Every Wednesday, it would be someone different's turn to go out with Dad for dinner because we couldn't really, you know, spend as much time as we wanted to with him. So it was not just acceptable but more stable for us to be with Mum because we had a house. Dad was the one that left our house. We didn't leave his house. Yeah, and just seemed to be the way it happened. At the moment, I live with my dad in Ferntree Gully, and it's just me, my dad, and he's one of his best mates. He just moved in about 6 months ago. I've been there for 4 years, I think. Just after Dad left, we always used to talk to Mum, and she would go on about never being married again until she was 60. Being a kid, I took that literally, that, you know, I'd have my mum together forever by myself for ages. And then when she met David, it all seemed a bit rushed. From my memory, it was, yeah, he's my boyfriend and we're getting married. Not, he's my boyfriend, time to adjust. We're getting married, time to adjust. But it was a little bit of time. It was just so hard for me to get used to. And being the oldest, I was the protector. I got to be defensive for my brothers and sisters. So me and David didn't get off to a very good start. And he had never had kids before. So at the time, he wasn't as tolerant as he is now. And also, we're so similar, as in we're both so stubborn, and that we just clashed. And it got to the point where I couldn't do it anymore. And I just said, because I'd threatened it on a number of times. But it got to the point where I'm just like, no, I can't do this. And I couldn't put my brothers and sisters through it anymore because I was very disruptive to the whole family. I just thought it would be better. Moved out and I said, no, that's it. And I need to come home just to pick up my stuff. It was a hard decision, but it was the best. My brothers and sisters don't really understand why I did it because they've never wanted to talk about it. I was 14 when I moved out, so they were still pretty young, didn't really know what was going on. They just knew that me and David fought a lot, and they were upset just as I was when I moved out. But because we haven't talked about it, I can't really say how it's affected them. Well, the first year when I was living with my dad was very lonely because he worked very long hours in the city. And for a while, I think probably the first couple of months, I barely came up here at all because I felt guilty for moving away and for finally doing it. And I felt really bad, like I didn't want David to think it was all his fault and then us not to get along again. But after a while, you know, I missed my brothers and sisters, so I had to come back. And me and my mum are really close, so I had to come back. It's never been consistent every second week, though, because I've got myself to and from. So it's usually every second to third week I come up for the weekend, and more frequently now that I'm older and I've got my licence. I think some of the really good things about living with my dad is I've got the independence that I've always needed because I've been independent since day one. I think it's also good for my dad because he was living by himself and feeling neglected and being lonely, and we've gotten to know each other so much better. And my brothers and sisters can feel a lot more comfortable because it's my house as well as my dad's house. And they can come in and just, you know, relax and see that everything's okay. Well, being the oldest of five, you're always the one to set the standard. And I've always felt so much pressure. Being a dad's, I've got, you know, this special attention that I've felt like I've always been deprived of because I've been the oldest. So I feel that I've got the extra support and the extra attention that I wouldn't have had here. You know, being in such a large family, you don't get that time. Mostly, I think, not as in chores and stuff that Dad's put extra on me, but emotionally, like he's never had anyone to talk to. So ever since I moved in, I've known everything. But the most problem I have is Mum saying one thing and Dad saying another, not about rules, but about each other and situations, you know, mostly probably money issues. You get one side of the story and then you get the other, and then you get caught in the middle about who to believe rather than what to do, just who to believe and who to listen to. Are they trying to get me on their side, or you just get really confused? There's been issues with, because I live with Dad and we're closer, I've been seen to be the favourite, and he does have a special spot for me, but that's what's caused the issues. It's not intentional, but because I live with him, we have a closer bond, especially between me and Sarah seem to be a bit of friction. Some of the things that I wouldn't feel comfortable talking about or sharing with my dad, I've had to hold on to myself because Mum's not there. You know, you do your girly thing, your girly chat. So that would be a bad thing. And just missing out on my brothers and sisters' day-to-day lives. Well, that I don't really know if they've got an excursion or if they got an A+ on their maths, or, you know, just the little things you like to be involved in, but they think it's irrelevant.
Laurie Maloney used to work in the mediation section of the family court, but now works at La Trobe University, where he and colleague Jen McIntosh set up the Children in Focus project. One of the issues that arises in the child inclusive mediation process is the recognition that children within the family and at different stages of development may have different needs.
I think one of the strengths of this program, though, is that because the people who are acting as child consultants do have a developmental perspective, they are working with each child at an appropriate age level. If you're working with a five-year-old, for example, a five-year-old will have all sorts of magical thinking. That'll be reflected in the way the child relates to the child consultant, but it will also be reflected in the feedback to the parents. I think that has been often missing in family law up to date. I've read a lot of judgments over the years and read a lot of reports and so on. And one thing I'm often struck by is the fact that the children are simply lumped together. You know, it would be in the interests of the children to do the following things or spend the following amount of time with each parent. In fact, the reality for each child is different, and that needs to be much better acknowledged, I think. If we've erred on one side or the other, I think we've erred on the side of not taking the voices of children sufficiently seriously. There was one terrific comment from one, I think she was a seven-year-old, who said, "The thing I liked about this person was she really listened hard." And it's a great way of putting it, I think.
Tony G from Relationships Australia explains that accommodating those different needs can be a real challenge.
In my experience, each child has a different family in some respects, because they do have different relationships to each parent and different relationships within their sibling group and so on. So I guess that can be accommodated in a number of ways. In one sense, well, I suppose if you're talking about the mediation process, depending on the ages of the kids can be talked to individually. Their views can be put forward as a group. Some of their thinking or some of their voices can be put forward as a group. There might be specific kind of plans or specific issues raised for specific children. I guess the other side of that too is translating that into post-separation parenting plans for children. And I guess the rule of thumb is kids tend to go as a block between households, and sometimes that works very well because of the sibling support group and so on. But I think I'd agree with Laurie, particularly as children get older and different genders and so on, I think there are cases for, in particular circumstances, for children having different arrangements within a family. It can be quite complex because you're not wanting to set up situations where there might be a competitiveness between kids. If one child's seeing Dad more, or, you know, one child's seeing Mum more or whatever, and you're wanting to protect their relationship, at the same time you want to respect that they're individuals and their world does operate differently and can operate very successfully, you know, with different plans.
I remember when my mum came and told me that she was pregnant. I knew it was going to happen. I knew they were going to have a baby, but I didn't know when. I wasn't prepared. And at the time, I was so angry because my whole world had been turned upside down with getting my mum having a new partner. And then all of a sudden we're going to have another kid. And I was like, whoa, isn't four enough? And I think I struggled with it because I remember our family unit before all this happened. At first I was really angry, but then once I got to sit down and think about it, I was like, this can't be so bad. And as soon as I saw Jack, it was like love at first sight. I'd never give him back. Well, even just to see Mum go through the process of being pregnant. Yeah, I got over it pretty quickly. But at first I was very angry. As soon as Mum had Jack, because she was in labour for like 24 hours, we got a phone call and we were there as soon as possible. My dad actually came and picked us up and took us to the hospital. I was the first one that got to hold him though, being the oldest. So that was pretty cool. And because I'm older, me and Jack have got a special bond. I look after him and he even calls me his second mum. Well, ever since I can remember, we've all just got to do whatever we want. Bathed him when he was a baby, changed his nappy, got him dressed, everything. Now that I've got my license and he's four, me and Jack get our special times where we get to go out and we'll go to the park and have Maccas or something, something special without the other kids, and he gets all excited. And it's really good when we go out, Mum, David and me and Jack, and he's like, yeah, the littlest and the biggest. But he's just amazing. Me, Mum and David are really close now. Now that I don't live with David and we're not in each other's faces and I've sort of got out of my awkwardness, we're just best friends. We'll just sit down, have a cup of coffee, have a chat. Don't have to hold back, just kick back, relax. I come up during the week, we put Jack to bed, and then we'll just watch TV on their bed. It's just like we're old friends. It's so good because he's my stepdad, and a lot of people don't have a relationship like that with their real dad. When I spend a lot of time up here, Dad gets lonely, but he is a little bit jealous because he doesn't have that same relationship with my brothers and sisters as I have with my mum and David. But he knows that, there's a place for him and there's a place for them, and that no matter what happens, we're all close. So he's pretty cool with it. I do remember knowing from day one that I think it was as soon as you turn 12, you can legally choose where you want to live, and they've never kept that from us. So I think that's good. But the actual decision-making of staying together or breaking up, no, because the kids don't know nothing when it comes to their parents and that sort of thing. But their options, they have to know, yeah. That's very important.
Some rather poignant music, as well as Jessica talking there about her family experience. And we also heard from Laurie Maloney of La Trobe University and Tony G from Relationships Australia. In next week's program, the final in the series produced by Robert DeYoung for us here on Life Matters, and we'll hear from Sarah, Jessica's younger sister, with her side of the story. And now on Life Matters, a spirited call to escape the rat race and leave the city far behind. Barry Cohen is a former federal Labor minister who recently upped stumps from the central coast of New South Wales to live in Bungendore outside Canberra in a semi-rural setting. Last week, he wrote in the Australian newspaper about his so-called tree change experience, and he joins me now to tell us more. Barry Cohen, welcome to Life Matters.
Morning, Kate.
Well, a recent survey found that people living in your new area are some of the happiest in Australia. You're not surprised about that, are you?
No, well, that's the university study by Deakin University about the well-being factor, and they discovered that the unhappiest people were in the inner city suburbs of Sydney, or some in the outer western suburbs. And the happiest people were those in what were described as poor rural communities. And I think that the happiest people were in Wide Bay, which is up in Maroochydore, but the second happiest were in Eden Monaro, which is where I live. And you're right. I mean, it didn't surprise me in the slightest. I can see a huge advantages in living, just out, in the, well, I'm not saying we're in the bush, but, in a rural community as we are now.
But you'd already left the city some time ago, though, hadn't you? Hadn't you already escaped?
Well, if you can call what we were doing leaving the city, yes. I mean, I'd lived for 35 years at Matcham, which is, and we're on, sort of 5 acres of bush. But when I went up there, 70, it was bush, it was country, and, 70,000 people lived there. Now there's 320,000 and growing. And Sydney still is your sort of base. You want to go anywhere to a function or anything like that. It's Sydney. Well, even when we were living in the wildlife sanctuary at Calgary, which we wanted to go anywhere into Sydney or into Gosford or Newcastle, it was tortuous. It was an hour and a half if you wanted to go to a show on a Friday night. You had to allow half an hour to get across the bridge. So, yeah, we were much more in the bush, and we wanted to remain in the bush. But the other thing, of course, was cost. Huge factor. I mean, we came down this area because our son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren were living here, and we wanted to be close to them.
So was it more about that, the positive experience of wanting to get closer to your family, wanting to be in the bush, or were there other things about cities that you wanted to get away from?
Well, cost was a big factor. If you wanted to live, sort of the sloth style we've been used to living, you were looking at it. $1 million for a home, and we couldn't afford that sort of money. We looked first of all in the Southern Highlands, and that's the most expensive. I said, we'd have to resume a life of crime to be able to afford to live there. It's beautiful. I mean, it's fantastic, but it's just more than we could afford. And then my son said to me, "Have you thought of looking outside Canberra?"
Well, you found Bungendore by accident, didn't you? What happened?
Well, he said to me, I hadn't thought of anything. He went and said Canberra. I said, "No, I don't want to live in a city, any city. I want to live in the bush." And he said, "Well, what about just outside Canberra?" And we started looking around, and, it was, I won't go into all the details, but it was sort of accidental. And what we were able to purchase here was, half what it would have cost us, at least in Sydney, and about a third less in the Southern Highlands. So, here we are, and we're closer to our family, because I've got lots of contacts in Canberra, so it's a very interesting social life for me.
For those who haven't been to Bungendore, though, what's it like? If you look out your window, what do you see?
Oh, well, here you are. I live in a street where there's a lot of beautiful homes, not dissimilar to our own, or it's even better than us. But, the beauty about it is everything's so available. The town has got all the basic amenities it wants. Butcher, baker, candlestick maker, pub, supermarket, And a great health centre. I was really worried about health because I'd be like any 70-year-old, you get a bit worried about things dropping off. So I thought, well, the best I'll have here is a witch doctor. But not only, they've got a family health centre with about 5 doctors and chemists, everything, and it's all available. It's there within 2 minutes drive and 10-minute walk, and that's the great beauty. I mean, don't misunderstand me. That article was written not just about Bungendore. It was about the other hundreds and maybe even more villages and towns, many of which have died, that are sort of 20, 30, 40, 50 kilometres from a major town like Dubbo or Wagga or Griffiths or Armidale or Tamworth or something like that. And these towns were thriving little towns, 50, 60 years ago, but when the war, after the war, when everybody was able to get a car and drive into the major town, these towns died. The commercial activity died, and the town, to a significant degree, died with them.
Well, let's talk more about that, because you mentioned, for example, that you do have access to health services at Bungendore, and last week the State of the Public Hospitals report was released, which found that still in a lot of rural Australia there's considerable disadvantage when it comes to health. So not all rural towns work the same way, do they?
You're absolutely right. I can't speak for all the townships around. But what I'm saying is this, that there is a, what I think governments have got a problem. I feel very sorry for them, particularly state governments, because they have to... The federal government decides what people come into this country, how many will come into the country, and then the state's got to provide the infrastructure for them. And, you know, you see the pressure that's being placed on New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, whatever, to do that. And they can't afford it. They haven't got the money to put up, you know, new roads and new and schools and all. But these towns already exist. They've got the infrastructure there. All that needs to happen, I believe, is that for governments, first of all, to let people know that you can sell up your home in Sydney or Melbourne or whatever and with half that money go and buy a nice home in one of these country areas. What governments need to do is to bolster for services, health in particular, that these communities have. It doesn't need to go and build whole new towns and suburbs, or not as many as it's doing at the moment.
Well, let's talk more about that, because there were some reports done recently about innovation in rural Australia, and it found that those small towns that were thriving and were working really well were those that are receptive to new ideas, to new people coming in, and also that have a really high turnover in things like leadership.
They have a what?
The ones that have a really high turnover in leadership of local organisations and so on. Was it hard for you to break into the new community, or were you welcomed?
Well, we didn't attempt to break in. We were welcome. I mean, the first day we were there was Melbourne Cup Day. The lady from across the road arrives with a freshly baked cake. The guy next door to me, he's out there mowing my lawn. I said, don't stop. I can use you every fortnight. But, I mean, this has never happened to me in my life before. We're just agog. And then they put on a party to welcome us. We made him feel very welcome. I mean, that's what you get. We're invited to the Bungendore Ball. I mean, it's a long time since I've done a knees up. But
and how did you go? What did you dance?
Well, I mean, I used to be a good dancer, but I'm not too good these days. But, you know, it wasn't just that. There's so much on in the bush. You know, there's agricultural show, dog shows, book fairs, book launches, exhibitions. Admittedly, Bungendore's got closer to a lot more activity than many of these communities, but there was just never a week, you know, even the pumpkin festival at Collector, we went over to that. The sort of thing...
That's a long way from federal politics, the pumpkin festival.
Well, you know, you're not a... I'm not a politician now, I can do what I like.
Well, but if you were a politician still, what would you be saying to the government? What else do they need to be doing to support these small towns and communities?
I think there's a need... Look, let's get one thing clear. I haven't rediscovered the wheel. I mean, there are lots of people that are doing what I'm doing. They're moving, you know, the sea changes and tree changes. What I'm saying to the government is to encourage people to look at these alternatives in living in the bush, to see the advantages you've got, the lower cost of housing, so you can put money in the bank and do whatever you want with it. The community welcoming... The warmth of a local community that you get being known and knowing other people. Say to the community, look, this is available for you if you don't want to start living in the city. Look, a lot of people have to live in the city because their jobs are there and all sorts of reasons. But a lot of people
There are even
don't.
People who love it.
Pardon?
There are even people who love it.
Of course, and don't misunderstand me. I love Sydney. I think it's the greatest city in the world, but it's becoming choked. I mean, this is not you know, as I said, I'm not rediscovering the world, but if a lot of people could move out of the city if they knew what was available for them in these bush towns and villages. It's up to the government, I believe, or it's in their interests, to alert people to what's available and then to try to improve the service to encourage them to go there instead of having to build, you know, whole new suburbs every few... you know, years on the outskirts of Sydney. I mean, Sydney, as I said, is a wonderful city, but it's gone backwards, in my view, over the last 10 or 15 years, badly so.
Well, Barry Cohen, thank you so much for that. And I know that here on Radio National, we'll keep an eye on things like those State of the Region reports that tell us how we're travelling in rural Australia, and do enjoy yourself there in Bungendore.
Thank you very much. Bye.
That's former Federal Labor politician Barry Cohen on his life changes that led him to live in Bungendore in New South Wales. But now on Radio National on Life Matters, it's time to hear from Ramona Cavall and find out what's coming up after the news on The Book Show. Hi, Ramona.
Hello, Kate. After The Book Show, we've got an interview with American writer and journalist Anne Jones. a shattering first-hand view of life in Afghanistan after the Taliban that Rhiannon Jones has done. So that's on the book show coming up shortly.
Wow, there seems to be a lot of Afghanistan on Radio National at the moment. I know Gerald Tooth's been going there for the media report as well, and we've heard some terrific stories from that. And do stay on Radio National to listen to Ramona. And tomorrow on Life Matters, we meet a midwife working in the Torres Strait and hear the latest on landmine clearances on Cambodia. Bye for now.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.